This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We'll do some supply chain today because, look, you try living without them. Also, trying to convince companies to be leery of China and the minds behind the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 22nd of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The theme of the first four or so minutes of the program today is a fairly fundamental one in this global economy in which we live. How does stuff get from where it's made to where we can buy it? Case study number one came from the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, in congressional testimony this morning, the topic of which was, among other things, the president's trade war with China. Secretary said he is in regular contact with Walmart and others, talking about what products they can and can't source from outside China and thus avoid the tariffs. Because that is, of course, the easy answer to all this tariff shenanigans, right? Just buy your stuff someplace else. Now, what does that actually mean for companies and how actually realistic might that be? We sent Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looking for the answer.
Short answer, depends on the company and the product. Brandon Fletcher, a retail analyst for Bernstein, has actually scored different companies on their adaptability to Chinese tariffs.
Costco and Walmart are extremely high on our list. Those are sophisticated global retailers with powerful sourcing teams that can do just about anything they want.
They sell lots of products under their own brands and so control where those products are sourced, unlike a Dollar General or Best Buy, which mainly sell outside brands.
And if they want to do electronics, then they run into the problem of China being, frankly, the place that you have to go.
Switching suppliers is harder for companies that need really specific components, say to make a generator or an excavator.
First of all, I have to find a supplier somewhere else. They may not exist.
Kip Eideberg with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
But even if they do, I then need to make sure that they have the right quality, have the right specs, the right cost. Then I would have to draw up an agreement with that supplier.
Figure out shipping, warehousing, contingency plans. It's easier if you already have a relationship with non-Chinese suppliers. Matt Priest is head of the Footwear Distributors and Retailers of America. His members have been shifting out of China for a while due to labor shortages and higher costs. But there's more urgency now.
Let's say you're 60% China and you're 30% Vietnam, you're 10% elsewhere. Yeah, you're already thinking through how do you get that 30% up to 40% in the next few weeks and then more so beyond that.
But he says building new relationships takes way more time. Making shoes requires a lot of skilled labor and space. It's one reason more production hasn't already left China. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Here's case study number two on the global supply chain technology division. Do me a favor, would you, and have a look at your phone. The semiconductor brains inside it, and thus the ability to communicate with your network of choice, most likely come from the San Diego company Qualcomm. It is the world leader in those mobile phone chips. Sadly for Qualcomm, then, that a federal judge has ruled that the way the company charges phone makers for its products is illegal and has, quote, strangled competition. Qualcomm said it is going to appeal, but if the ruling stands, it'll likely have to overhaul its whole business model, which would then raise some interesting questions about American competitiveness in the critical next generation of wireless. That's known as 5G. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one from Washington.
At issue in this case is how much Qualcomm charged smartphone makers like Apple and Samsung. It's complicated, but the buyers had to pay two fees. one for the chips and one for the licenses. And that was unreasonably high, according to the ruling, which now requires Qualcomm to renegotiate with phone manufacturers. Law professor Tom Cotter at the University of Minnesota says this could undo Qualcomm's whole way of doing business.
They're going to have to change it quite extensively if the opinion is affirmed on appeal. That's billions of dollars for Qualcomm's bottom line.
In years past, Qualcomm has taken revenue and plowed it into research and development for the next generation of mobile chips. And today, next is fifth generation wireless, or 5G. Analyst Roger Entner is with Recon Analytics.
It certainly has less money for R&D left over, and that can certainly impact the competitive situation of Qualcomm and the United States as a whole.
U.S. competitiveness against China is at stake here, according to Qualcomm. The company has allies in Congress and the Justice Department who argue that Chinese technology is a spying threat, so Qualcomm's health is a matter of national security. That's debatable, says George Contreras. He teaches law at the University of Utah.
You don't need this business model to be a successful chip company. And the proof of that is every other chip company in the world throughout history.
He says U.S. chip makers like Intel innovate and thrive without charging the fees that Qualcomm has. The company says it'll appeal, which means this fight over U.S. industry and national security will go on. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I'd be remiss here if I didn't note that the Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting today. Pretty much status quo is the short version. Interest rates are going to stay right where they are as long as inflation stays where it is, which is to say low. On Wall Street today, kind of bouncy. Actually, to the downside, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Financial Times reported this past weekend that a bipartisan group of U.S. senators, along with intelligence officials, have been meeting with American business leaders, entrepreneurs, and academics to talk about, well, to warn them of, really is better language, the dangers of doing business with and in China. Intellectual property theft, forced technology transfer, the usual stuff in terms of danger and threat. The thing that caught my eye was that they are sharing classified information. Those lawmakers are to make their case. Virginia Senator Mark Warner is one of the senators involved. He is also the vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Senator Warner, welcome back to the program, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
So here you are, the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, holding briefings with American companies, sharing, as I understand it, classified information with them to alert them to the nature of the threat. First of all, are you sharing classified information with American companies? And second of all, how unusual is that?
Well, I've convinced the intelligence community that we really aren't doing our job unless we can also read in American businesses, American academic institutions, American venture capital funds. And so we've put together a process where firms are read in for a special classified briefing. Mm-hmm. I always do this with a Republican partner, Republican senator, so that we can show that this is not just the Trump administration or the variety of heads of our intelligence agencies and FBI and Department of Homeland Security, but it's also a bipartisan group of senators that believe this is a issue of national security, that they need to hear the story about why we think this is such a threat.
What is the reaction from these companies? And let me just pick one, Apple, which, as you know, is enormously dependent on the Chinese market. What are CEOs like Tim Cook saying to you when you say, you know what, you need to rethink your relationship with China?
I think from some companies, we are hearing that willingness to rethink. We hear from a number of companies who made major investments in China. In many ways, a number of American companies, in a sense, almost sold their soul to try to get into the Chinese market and make compromises they would have made nowhere else. And I think many of those companies realized, oh my gosh, this may have been a mistake because there's been theft of our intellectual property. We've seen from some of the startup companies a recognition of, oh yeah, I wondered why that Chinese firm was willing to pay me 5-1 over what a Western firm was willing to pay for an investment. But there are also some others that candidly don't want to hear the whole story. And that's where we continue the conversation. Right.
You have seen, I'm sure, in the press or perhaps heard here on Marketplace, this phrase called the tech iron curtain coming down with news of Huawei and Qualcomm and everything that's been happening. What do you make of what looks to be a separation of the global technology supply chain into the West and now China? And what will that mean?
I think we've not fully thought through the implications. I do think the idea that if you can buy a piece of hardware or software at a 30% discount, but the cost of that is really to have a vulnerable system, not only our communication system, but all of the so-called Internet of Things devices that may be connected to that next generation system are vulnerable. I think that's not a good deal for American or for Western companies. And my beef is not with the Chinese people or that China is a nation. They're a great nation. My concern is with President Xi and the Communist Party in China, and I hope it'll be something that we'll keep in mind as we go down this policy front.
So look, sir, you've been a senator for a long time. You were governor before that. But before that, you were a business person. You were a venture capitalist. That's how you made your money. So let me talk to Mark Warner, the business person, and say, look, you sell one of anything to 1.4 billion Chinese. You're doing pretty well. What is the answer to this problem from a business person's perspective who feel that they have to be in that market?
The answer is, if you're selling short-term into that Chinese market, but the price of selling into that market means that you have to build facilities and leave some of your intellectual property there, and 3 years later, there is a Chinese equivalent with exactly your business practices and intellectual property, I'm not sure you've made long-term a smart business deal, because you may not only lose out on the Chinese market, but that Chinese company may then be able to take your technology and sell to the global market at large with a level of subsidies and support from the Communist Party in China that, candidly, the American government and Western governments don't do for our companies.
Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Senator, thanks very much for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Kai, thank you.
According to people who watch this stuff pretty closely, the Food and Drug Administration is expected to approve a big new drug from Novartis by the end of the month. It's a gene therapy drug that treats a rare disease called spinal muscular atrophy, which in its worst form can be fatal for babies born with it. It is, however, going to be expensive, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Novartis hasn't set the price tag for the new drug, Zolgensma, which treats defective genes, but industry analysts expect it will be anywhere from $1.5 to $5 million per patient.
So when you think about how expensive a drug is, it's important to think about the value it provides.
Dr. David Rind is with ICER, a research group that analyzes drug prices. He says this drug could potentially save the lives of hundreds of children every year. But still,
if they come in at $4 or $5 million, that's not reasonable value for this therapy, even given the wonderful things that it does.
He says $1.5 million would be a fair price. But really, Novartis can price the drug however it wants, says Rena Conti, who teaches health policy and law at Boston University.
There is absolutely no pricing pressure that reduces the amount of money that Novartis or any other company can charge.
Novartis did not respond to our request for comment. There is a limit, however, to what insurance companies will pay. David Merritt is with the industry group America's Health Insurance Plans.
And we have to figure out a way to balance access with affordability because, you know, these new therapies are useless if no one can afford them.
The affordability issue will only grow. The FDA expects to approve 10 to 20 expensive gene and cell therapy drugs every year for the next several years. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You never hear the words here like, close enough. Good enough.
How to make your vision come to life as a hit television show. But first, let's do the numbers.
Dow Industrials off 100 points today, 0.4%, 25,776 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 34 points, about 0.4% as well, 77.50. The S&P 500 down 8 points, 0.2%, 28.56. There, big earnings day today on Wall Street, especially for retail. Target beat expectations. For the first quarter, stock was up more than 7%. Other retailers, not so much. Nordstrom. Come on, guys. Shed over 9% today after missing expectations and slashing its forecast for the year. L Brands, the parent company of Victoria's Secret and Bed Bath & Beyond, down 5% today. Earlier in the week, the picture seemed rosy for the Sprint T-Mobile deal, but it looks like the Justice Department might step in to block it. Sprint down 7%, T-Mobile down 1% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.38%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, I'm Molly Wood, host of Marketplace Tech. On our show, we go beyond the latest gadget announcements to talk about the ideas behind the newest technology and how tech is changing our lives, our jobs, and our economy. It'll make you think differently about the tech you use at home and at work. Join me each weekday for Marketplace Tech. Find it wherever you like to podcast.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to start the second half of the program today in New York City, a comedy club in Greenwich Village, 1958. Actress Rachel Brosnahan as the title character in Amazon's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, lamenting the end of her marriage, which becomes, in a way, the beginning of the story.
I was fun. I planned theme nights. I dressed in costumes. I gave him kids, a boy and a girl. And yes, our little girl is looking more and more like Winston Churchill every day, you know, with a big Yalta head. But that's not a reason to leave, right?
Mrs. Maisel is the latest from the mind of Amy Sherman Palladino and her husband Dan Palladino, the pair behind the Gilmore Girls, if you remember that from 15-something years ago.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, Kai.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Nice to see you.
I recognize the
voice. Well, that's great. Thank you.
Hi,
how are you? Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for making the time.
Sure.
Amy, why don't you tell us where we are?
At this moment?
Yeah, right now.
We're sitting in our producer's office because I don't know why we didn't want to let them into the inner sanctum of our offices. Is that it's my office?
It's top secret stuff.
The pigsty. We're at our offices at Steiner Studios, where we're shooting The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, season 3, aka the next 10 years that will be taken off my life.
And from there, we were off and running.
How did this show come to be? Have you been carrying this woman around in your brain for years and years?
My father was a stand-up, and it was a world that was always talked about in my house, the world of Catskills and Greenwich Village, and my dad was from the Bronx, and I always thought that would be a delightful, entertaining place to live for a while, to place a show. I just thought that the story would be more interesting with a chick. I just thought it would be a more interesting battle. So my father was turned into Rachel Brosnahan.
Yeah.
I'm
is
not
your dad
sure.
still around? How does he
He's
feel about
not.
That?
He's not. I hope he would take it in the spirit that it's intended, which is an homage with a tinier waist and more skirts. it just felt like a fun world to a colorful world. You know, Gilmore was wonderful,
Gilmore
delicious.
Girls, we should say.
Gilmore
the,
Girls.
The prior creation, yeah.
Was a wonderful, delicious, creative experience, but we were in the back lot in Burbank, and we basically walked two girls in a circle for 6 years, and we wanted something, a bigger palette. And
So to that point, Dan, this is ambitious. This is unbelievably ambitious.
Or mentally unbalanced.
Well,
is it both of those?
Because you're setting an era. This show has a visual style that is unbelievable. We're going to talk to Donna, the costume designer, in a bit. All of it's intentional. All of it clearly is of a vision from you two. How closely do you have to guard that vision? I mean,
well, the trick to having a vision like that is having people who have the skills and to know how to bring about that vision.
And it's important you don't have anybody around that has, like, you never hear the words here like, close enough. Good enough.
Which
you would hear a lot on other shows, and then you'd panic and you'd be like, it's not close enough. No, not good. You know, nobody here does that. You can't ever say like, well, I mean, is anyone really going to see that? Because like someone will kill you. They will just throw something at you because like everybody here, it's very important to them that the costumes are perfect, that the sets are perfect. Everything is perfect. And when you work with people like that, then the bar just always stays very high.
The final product that we see when we sit down or we pull up whatever screen we're watching on, so you have the vision and you farm it out, as it were, and you trust your people because you've hired them and they're good. But then does it come back and everything we see on the screen goes through y'all's hands?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because we direct. Yeah,
that's really funny.
Yes.
Dan's like, well, yes. And Dan's like, yeah, stop. Yeah.
We direct most of the episodes. So we have the luxury of, as writer-directors, we write sometimes to our directing. So we have an idea if most of TV, writers write and the directors come in and direct, and that's a system that works great. We did that on Gilmore Girls, and we do have a few outside directors on this because we've realized we can't do it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
But basically, we're able to fashion scenes on the page in a way that writers wouldn't unless they were also directing.
But it also, you know, there's different pieces to making a show. There's the writing, then you bring in the actors and the director, and then you have the editing, you have the post. So there's three chances to save it or screw it up. Because we are involved with every aspect of that, including every, you know, the entire editing process goes through our hands. We, because we feel a big responsibility.
Sure.
You know, Amazon has opened a checkbook, and and it's to this day has not bounced. And we feel very responsible to deliver on what we have promised.
A word here about Amazon. Could this show, minus, I guess, the swearing, right, which is actually elemental to a lot of the characters, could this show have been on a regular network?
No, not in a million years. First of all, they wouldn't have bought it. Midge is just not a character they would have had any interest in. They would have liked Rachel dressed up in a cute outfit walking around making brisket, and it would have stopped there. I don't think this journey is something. It's an unconventional journey. It's
say more about that, because there are people who haven't necessarily watched it who hopefully will after this, but explain that journey a little bit.
Well, you know, she's a woman who was very, very happy in her life.
1959
housewife, Jewish. And her life was great, and she thought, I have it all. I'm married. I got the two kids. I'm the queen of my six blocks.
Right.
You know, I what I really wanted for this character is I did not want her to be one of those 1950s housewives who pours her sherry at 4 o'clock and stares out a window and thinks there's got to be something better out there. I wanted a woman who really thought, I have it all. And through a fluke of circumstance and that the rug being pulled out from under her, she discovers something she never would have discovered, did not even know that there was a burning ambition in her, didn't know about ambition.
So you have a meeting with Amazon and you give them what I'm assuming is a truncated version of that discourse you just gave me about Midge.
Amy doesn't do truncation.
No,
very
okay,
well.
All right. So you gave him the spiel.
Yeah,
And I talk till their eyelids sort of start to flutter, and then they'll just do anything to get you out of their office.
So they bought the series.
Anything to get you out of their office. We'll buy it.
It's a form of hostage taking.
Yes, yeah. It's a little vicious.
Huh. So as we sit here, you guys are mid-ish production season three, mm-hmm. right? Early, I guess.
Towards the beginning.
Do you see the tears?
No, but I'm sure it'll come, there will be blood on the wall at some point, right? What are Emmys, yay, Golden Globes, yay. Look, you're shrugging. This is funny. What are your markers for success is the question.
The work, the show. I think you judge your success by, are you doing work that you enjoy? Are you working with people who make you better? And, you know, at the end of the day, are you putting something out there that you feel like it almost killed me, but it didn't kill me? So that's a big win.
After season one came out, we were on a plane about a week or two after it came out, and I sort of took a walk down to the back, and I was kind of walking around, and I spotted someone watching Maisel on a computer.
That was
is exciting. Like, that is like, I went back to her, and I was like, he's watching Maisel back there. Now, he wasn't laughing, But I did.
Well, it's not always funny.
I know. I did go back again, and he was watching the next episode. So that's. I think that's the. That was really fun. Connecting with people is really great. We had a huge connection with people on Gilmore Girls, emotional connection. Yeah.
But on Gilmore Girls, the connection came many years later. Yeah. I mean, Gilmore Girls was very small when it was on, and then it literally was when Netflix picked it up that suddenly it became a whole other thing. You know, we were like grandma and grandpa walking down the street, and like 18-year-olds are like, oh, my God, Gilmore Girls, my favorite show. And I'm like, impossible. You were a fetus. I don't even understand how.
My 12-year-old.
Yeah. It's a thing, and that's the thing about Maisel that's so different and kind of cool is it's happening while we're still doing Maisel. It's nice that they're watching it now while we're still alive.
Amy Sherman Palladino, Dan Palladino. We're going to end on that one. Thanks you two so much. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Thank you, this was very lovely.
There was more, lots more in that talk. How they feel about the whole streaming thing, for one. You can hear the whole conversation on our Corner Office podcast. Also, remember what I said about talking to Mrs. Maisel's costume designer? That's at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, another item from Treasury Secretary Mnuchin's testimony on Capitol Hill this morning. The secretary was asked about the redesign of the $20 bill. You might remember it was promised a couple of years ago by then Secretary Jack Lew. Harriet Tubman was going to replace Andrew Jackson on the front of the bill to be released in 2020, the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, affirming women's right to vote in this country. Anyway, that is not happening. Mnuchin said today no redesign until 2028 at the earliest. He is more concerned with making currency more counterfeit-proof, it seems. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 100 points today. The century mark, 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 34, 0.4% there as well. S&P 500 down 8 points, about 0.2% on that index. Our media production team includes Sarah Breguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.